This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
There was nothing left. It was unsurvivable.
In 2008, Tom Wilson had a career as a business manager. He had an on-again, off-again girlfriend, Lasha, but the main focus in his life was his job.
I was so invested in my career. I loved heavy construction. You know, I had friends, and I partied a lot, and I watched UFC, and I was making a lot of money, and I was in my mid-30s, and I was really invested in myself, and that's just how I was built.
Tom's big shot career had him traveling to work sites. And in November of 2008, he was going to a remote construction site on the west coast of Canada. Tom had made the trip before, flying from Edmonton to Vancouver, and then taking a small float plane to the site. But this time, something felt different.
And I had this strange sensation, like this, just this odd feeling in my gut that I just didn't feel right. But there was no logical reason, and so I just kind of dismissed that and kept going.
When Tom woke up the morning of the float plane flight, the weather was not ideal.
The cloud ceiling was low, visibility was nothing, and so we were driving to the airport in this cab, and we were talking about it, and we figured there was no way we were going to fly, right? It didn't make sense. But we still need to go to the airport, right? We still need to check in, we still need to report for work, and then when the flight is ready to go, then we'll go. Like, it's the Vancouver International Airport. And so there's a lot of flights out of there. And the flight status boards, when we walked into the airport, were all lit up in red. Every flight was either canceled or delayed that morning. So we went to our check-in counter, and it was me and Kyle.
Kyle Adams.
And then at the check-in counter, we started to meet some of the other guys. So Matt was there.
Matt Sachenko.
Jerry Burns was there. AJ was there.
AJ Cariappa.
AJ was a friend of mine for 12 years. We were all there. Tom Wargar was there.
There was also Wally Clemens.
And so we were all gathered as a group, and they instructed us to board our plane anyway, which was weird. It was awkward. It didn't make any sense, right? Everything's canceled. And so they wanted us to be ready for when they decided to fly. So we did. We started walking towards the aircraft, and we went out the doors and walking across the tarmac because it's a small plane.
The plane was a Grumman Goose float plane that takes off from the water. 8 people were on the plane. Peter McLeod, who was the pilot, and 7 others, including Tom, that worked for the same company.
And so we get to the plane, and the pilot's standing there. He's waiting for us, and he's usually there to greet you. And he takes all your luggage, and he puts the luggage in the belly of the aircraft while you board. And so we all board the plane. And we sit down, and so there's this really awkward, nervous energy. Usually we're just kind of like going to work and everything's great, but it's off, right? Like, we're getting on an airplane, you can't see anything. I know, we all know we're flying into the mountains.
Yeah.
Right? And so these planes are probably 40, 50 years old at the time. So they're kind of scary too, right? And so we're all just kind of sitting there looking at each other. And so the pilot gets onto the plane. He walks to the front of the aircraft, and all of us are in our seats. And he starts the aircraft. He puts his headsets around his neck, and he looks back at us in the passenger cabin through this opening. And he's like, "Hey, guys, we're going to have to do some low-level flying because of the weather conditions. If anyone has a problem with that, let me know now, and I'll let you off." And it was almost like shock, right?
Yeah.
So, and these things are small, so we're really close to each other, and the eye contact was crazy, and we're looking at each other like, don't even really know what to say. And
yeah,
like, every one of us was scared, and everyone knew it wasn't right. And so we all kind of had this second of echoing silence, and then in the next breath, the pilot says, "Hey, look, it's my job to make sure it doesn't get exciting. So if it gets too exciting, we'll just turn around, we'll come back, we'll have coffee." And so we're all kind of looking at each other and no one said anything. So the pilot put his headsets back on and we started to roll.
Unfortunately, things were about to get exciting in the worst way possible. This is Live to Tell, the podcast where I talk to some of the bravest people who have been through the most horrifying things and lived to tell the tale. I'm Caitlin Van Maul. Had you made this flight before?
Yeah, I'd been to Torbay Inlet at least twice before, and both times I flew with Peter McLeod, and both times it was on the same aircraft. So when you're taking off, like it's just this, it's like a canoe, right? And you can hear the waves just smashing against the bottom of the plane, and it echoes through, and you've got earplugs in because it's so loud. So everyone's kind of nervous. And so now we're in the air and we're cooking. We're doing 150 miles or 130 miles an hour. And we're 150 feet above the ocean water. So what do? I jam my knees up in the seat in front of me. I put my hoodie up and I rested my head against the window.
Tom went to sleep, but then...
And all of a sudden there's this noise. And so you'd think if you were in a plane crash, it'd be the impact that would jolt you, right? No, it was just noise. And this noise was... Yeah, unexplainable. It was like metal being ripped apart, grinding. It was just like, it was excessive. And so my eyes shot open right away. It was the trees that were ripping the plane apart that was creating the noise. And so I literally got the visual of these trees. And before I had enough time to recognize how much trouble we're in or we're going to be in a plane, for that to even register, I was thrown into the seat so hard and then it just... I was unconscious until I woke up, right? Mm-hmm. And it was over that quick. No one on the plane crash said, holy shit, or hang on, or nothing. It was just, we were just flying along for 22 minutes and then we weren't. When I wake up, it's one of the hardest things to describe because it was, I've got no chance of describing to you what it feels like to be soaked in aviation fuel burning alive. You cannot relate. But what I can tell you is that it's the closest thing to insanity that I've ever experienced. It was the most amount of pain that I could have possibly ever imagined or taken. Mm-hmm. But the problem is the next second it gets worse, and it gets worse, and it gets worse, and it gets worse, and it gets worse. And you feel like your heart's going to stop because you can't even handle any more pain. So I'm burning alive and screaming and I'm trying to stand up out of this chair and out of my seat and get out of the fire and pull away like any animal would. And I couldn't because my seatbelt was still on. And so I'm losing my mind and it's getting worse and I'm screaming and I can't, even though my mind knew how easy it was to undo that seatbelt. All I had to do was reach down and grab this big metal clip. I couldn't get my hands to listen. And so I sat back, literally I sat up in my chair and I put my hands straight up in the air and I let myself burn. And I let myself burn for just a split second, right? Just long enough to try and get enough control of my own body that I could force my hands to reach down. And so my hands are on fire and everything's on fire. And so I reached into the fire and I got the seatbelt off. I was able to do it. And I stood up and I'm screaming, it's getting worse and it's getting worse. And if there was anything left of that wreckage, if I had to negotiate a door, if I had to negotiate seats around me, if I had to negotiate anything, I wouldn't have been able to do it. I just would have burned to death and died.
Yeah.
I couldn't even control my own body. Was in such an override. And so I stood up and I started running. And because there was nothing left of the plane, I literally ran directly into the forest. And this created the next problem because the top of my hoodie was the most soaked with aviation fuel. And as I started to run, all the flames blew in the opening. So it burnt all the skin off my face as I'm running on fire and I'm screaming. And so I get to this clearing, you know, whatever it is, a few feet away on the side of this mountain, and I start pulling off all my clothes. So I take off my jacket, I take off my hoodie, and I'm still burning. I take off my shirt, I had my work boots and my jeans left on. And so my jeans are still on fire. And so I'm jumping around. And so I'm smacking all this fire, and I finally get all this fire out. And so I'm not wearing anything other than my jeans and my work boots, middle of November. And I stood in this clearing where I was, and I put my hands beside me again, up in the air. And I could see my palms hanging down because there was no flesh on the top of my hands to hold on to them anymore. I could see my flesh in front of my eyes hanging down from my face. I could smell my own burnt flesh. My stomach was scut. My legs were burnt. My back was burnt. And I stood in that field and I screamed. And I screamed. And I screamed harder and longer than I ever thought of. I just stood there and screamed. And this is the insanity that I'm talking about. There was so much pain that I just stood in this field and all I did was scream. I wasn't thinking about what happened, where was I, why, nothing. I just stood there screaming. And the only thing that started to bring the sanity back was exhaustion. And so as I started to get exhausted from screaming, I started to think about, like, whoa, what the hell just happened, right? Like, what's going on?
Tom looked around and took in all the destruction around him.
And this is a moment that I don't share. This is a moment that I don't share with anyone because I just don't. The things I saw that day were terrible. All of my friends were dead. And there was no noise. And so a part of it, in hindsight, was my earplugs had melted into my ears. But it seemed so silent. I remember going back to the wreckage and there's this death all around me. And it's so silent. And all I could hear was like the fire burning, just the crackle of fire. And I just lost it. I just started crying. I went from life to literally within 60 seconds. I'm standing on the side of this mountain, burned really bad, and everyone's dead. And they're not. They're shredded. It was violent. And I just stood there and I cried for a while. It's hard to describe, but because you're in so much pain, but you start to have your sanity back. And so I was in the Reg Force military. And so, I've had some training of being in the field. And the first thing I thought of was, no one's coming, right? I'm standing on the side of this mountain. I don't know where I am. I wasn't paying attention. My eyes were closed. I have no idea where we are. And I can't see 50 yards because I'm still in the cloud ceiling. I knew that no one would allow risking the lives of their people to come search for us in those conditions. I just knew they would. So I made the decision to leave the aircraft. I needed to try and find immediate help. I needed to find rescue. And so I started to climb down on the side of this mountain, the path in which the plane had came. And so I had to do this game of Twister. And I'm trying to climb down, literally climb down a mountain. And I can't use my hands. Everything's burnt. It's November 16th. It's raining. And so I get to this 3-foot drop. It's only a 3-foot drop. My 11-year-old daughter could navigate it, but not in that condition. And so I wiggled onto my butt and I remember trying to slide down, and it's only 3 feet and I should be able to land on my feet. And as soon as I started to slide over the ledge and it started to scrape my back that was burnt, I jumped forward. When I landed on the ground, I fell forward and I landed on my hands. And my hands and my face were by far the worst.
Tom thinks he spent about 2.5 hours trying to find the shore, all the while twisting and turning so his burned flesh didn't get scraped by the trees.
And then I get to the shore and I'm below the cloud ceiling. And so now I can actually see across the bay. And so it's kind of like you finally get to the shore and I'm on an island. Like, really? It's kind of terrible news. But I can see houses and I can see them across the bay. And I can see boats in the bay.
He tried for an hour to jump and wave to get someone's attention across the bay, but to no avail. It was also November in Canada, and Tom had no shirt on.
And so I'd go back into the trees, and I'd sit there and I'd try and gather my stamina long enough to go back out on the rocks. And it was less enthusiastic, right? It was like, come on, man. It's like, really? You know, really? Just, can someone please see me? And no one did. And so I kept doing that. And so it was at about the 4 hour mark and I knew I was dying and I was giving up hope on anyone seeing me. No one was coming. Nothing was changing. I was in so much pain and I knew I didn't have much longer. And so I decided to try and climb back up the mountain, and get back close to the wreckage because I knew everything was still on fire. Maybe I could get close enough to keep warm enough to live a little longer, you know, without causing too much pain for my burns. And so I'm trying to get back through the forest, back to this wreckage. And so I'm about 100 meters back into the forest and I hear a helicopter. It's getting loud. I'm looking around. I'm trying to find this helicopter. I can't see it. And I know it can't see me because I'm under the canopy of the forest again. Mm-hmm. So what do? Right? This is your moment, right? It's been an eternity and they can't see you. And so I turn back towards the water and I run and I go back to this place of insanity and I get to the rocks and the helicopter's gone. And at that point, when the helicopter was gone, I was so mad at God. I started screaming at God, why? And what I wanted to know was why? Why did you burn me and then make me see the things you made me see, make me make the decisions I had to make and endure the pain that I had to endure to take my life on this goddamn island anyway? Why did you punish me? And I was so mad. And I didn't want to live anymore. I had fought really, really hard for a long time. And I didn't have anything left. And I just didn't have any hope left. And so I wanted to die. When I gave up, when I was done yelling at God, and I just accepted that I wanted to die and I stopped fighting, man, it was the loneliest moment of my life, by far, like no other. I would have given everything I had just to my mom. I just wanted to tell her I loved her before I died. I wanted to call my dad. I wanted to call Lasha. But I couldn't. And it was just, it was really, really lonely. And then I hear an engine. Like, really? Another engine. But this time it's a Zodiac. And the Zodiac starts coming around the corner and it's search and rescue.
A rescue team had arrived from across the bay in a Zodiac boat.
And I'll never forget, I was such an asshole to these guys. So this Zodiac search and rescue comes around the corner and they're slow rolling in to approach me and he yells out, he's like, hey, were you in a plane crash? Right, and I look around, I'm standing here with no clothes, I'm burnt, like, yeah, I was in a plane crash, you know? And so the next question, he's like, is there anyone else alive? So I replied back, no.
It was awkward getting Tom into the boat while trying not to scrape any of his skin. But they managed and rushed him back across the water and into an ambulance.
And so when I saw the ambulance driver, it's one of the first times that I begged. And I begged them to put me to sleep, right? This has been, you know, 4.5 hours. I begged them to put me to sleep. And they were trying to ask me all these questions. I just kept begging, right? Please just put me to sleep.
But the ambulance driver didn't have the proper license to give him those drugs.
And so they sent another ambulance halfway. They switched me ambulances on the highway because the other ambulance did have the authority to administer the drugs I needed. And they put me to sleep. The next time I woke up, I remember I was kind of pissed off because we were landing on top of Vancouver General Hospital. So Vancouver is this big city and, you know, I'm in a helicopter and landing on top of the hospital and I kind of wake up and I missed it all. And I was like, you know, I kind of missed the helicopter ride.
And you weren't like, oh my God, I'm in the air again.
No, no.
When Tom got to the hospital, There was no immediate rush to surgery. They didn't even bandage him. He needed to be stabilized before they could even clean his wounds.
One of the things that the doctors and everyone else has said is that it wasn't humanly possible for the body to go through that kind of deceleration and that kind of violence without having any broken bones or internal injuries. If you look at the wreckage of the crash, literally the cockpit's gone, the tail's gone, the wing's gone, the seats around me are gone. You think of the force that it requires to shred metal like that. And it was shredded all around me, except it's like I was in this bubble.
Tom's sister was the first of his family to get to the hospital.
I'm laying in this hospital bed, and my sister, who's 10 years older than me, is really, really close to me. And I remember I was laying in this bed, and I was probably about the calmest I had been until my sister walked in. And my sister walked in, and I just had this giant emotional dump about everyone's dead, everyone's dead. And you know, just with what I, because now it's my sister, right? I live this person. Oh my God, I just had this dump. And so this went on for about 15 minutes. And the nurse finally is like, listen, we have to take you out of here, right? We need him to calm down. And so they took my sister out. And so here's a story my sister didn't tell me until years later. And she was in tears when she told me. She's like, she remembers from her perspective. She came into that room and she saw me. And so again, not bandaged, not cleaned, and I'm in bad shape. And so when they took her outside, she went for a smoke because she smokes too. And she started crying, having a smoke because she knows me. And she thought at that moment in time that once I knew how I looked, I wouldn't want to live anymore. Now the next morning is when my dad arrives. My dad is one of the toughest men I've ever met. He used to be a professional boxer back in Scotland, you know, immigrated, been a blue collar worker in a large factory his whole life. He's just this tough old bird. And the nurse comes in and she's got my dad and my brother. And so she says to my dad, this is Thomas. And my dad's like, no, it's not. And the nurse is like, no, you know, this is your son, Thomas. And my dad starts to get really upset because he wouldn't accept that it was me. And so my brother puts his hand on my dad's shoulder and he says, Dad, look at his tattoos. That's Thomas. And so as soon as my dad looked at my tattoos, I never seen my dad ever break like that. He shattered into a million pieces on the floor. He didn't know how to stand still. He didn't know whether to come and hug me or to run away. He just broke. And I'd never seen that before.
Finally, Tom was stable enough to clean and dress his burns. The first step in this process is a chemical bath.
But a chemical bath is probably the most painful thing that doctors can do to a human. And so what they do is they submerge your body and chemicals, and they use like a modified barbecue brush to try and scrub the debris and infection, and because you literally have no skin to defend yourself from infection, so they really got to scrub you. And I remember them putting me in the gurney to wheel me over to this bath, and I remember being beside this bath and I'm screaming and I'm begging, I'm like, please don't, like, I'll be okay. They have to scrub the rocks out of my hands. They have to scrub the dirt. They have to scrub any infection. Mm-hmm. They literally scrub all of your dead skin off. They scrub all of the stuff out of the wounds. It's torturous.
And it's why torturous. Did you need to be awake for that?
I'm not sure. They did explain that too, though.
Okay.
They did explain that too.
After the scrubbing, they were finally able to bandage him up. Given how much of his head and hands were burned, he looked like he was about to be replaced by another actor on Days of Our Lives.
But the burns on the hands and the face, they wrapped me in. So there was this technology they were trying to use, and it was some sort of chemical that encouraged the regeneration of skin growth. And so these bandages were soaked, right? They weren't dry. They were really, really wet. And they'd wrap them around my hands. And so in between all my fingers, and because I had no skin anywhere. And so they'd wrap all my hands, and then they wrapped my entire face and my entire head. So you could only see my blue eyes, and you could see my lips.
He was then transferred to the University of Alberta Hospital in Edmonton. Luckily, Tom's company offered the use of their private plane, so Tom didn't have to fly commercial all wrapped up. The University of Alberta Hospital was much closer to home for Tom, but this part of his recovery wasn't going to be any easier than what he'd already gone through.
They'd have to come in and they'd have to take off my bandages every single day. And they'd come in, they'd given me additional morphine, just because of the amount of pain with it. And so they had to unwrap my bandages. And as you're unwrapping them, the bandages stick. Like it just sticks to your burns like any other wound. And it's not a little Band-Aid. It's my entire hands, both front and top and fingers. And it's constant. And it was torturous. And then once they were done removing the bandages, this little East Indian fellow, he was the kindest person. I just hated him. But I hated him for his job. Right?
Yeah.
He'd put on his blue surgical gloves and he'd put his hand literally on top of mine. And again, I'd literally be begging them not to. And he'd put his hand on top of mine and he'd use his fingers to squeeze my fingers and make them bend. Because they need to make sure that you continually move your joints and your fingers and stuff so that when your skin grows back, it grows back very, very tight. And so they need to just try and keep moving you. And so, you know, imagine how that felt, this guy squeezing my hand after he had just undone my bandages. And then they'd bandage me back up. And then I'd go through the rest of my day and the doctors would come in and, you know, then the family would come in and, you know, then I'd typically get a candy delivery. People sent me all kinds of candy to the hospital. And then, you know, it'd just be another day. The next morning they'd come in and yeah. In the anticipation, I just hated mornings. Here's your estromorphine, and then in next is undo the bandages, and you're on this cycle of repeat, and it's just repeat, and it's so painful. I've had broken legs before. I've had a broken jaw before. There's a point in time where it doesn't take your entire existence because you've got a moment of reprieve for the way you're sitting. Mm. With burns, that's not the case. There's no second of reprieve. It's constant.
We'll be right back. During these agonizing days in the burn ward, Tom reassessed so much of his workaholic lifestyle.
I tried to resign from Kiewit. I had been there for like 10 years. So I was friends with my boss, and he was one of the few people I allowed in my hospital room. Mm-hmm. I didn't let very many in. And I tried to resign. And I'm like, listen, man, I am never, ever, ever leaving my family again. Right? I'm never going away. I'm never leaving. I'm never going on a construction project. Like, I can't work for you anymore. I can't do it. And so, obviously, they didn't accept my resignation. But the pendulum went so far the other way. And it was just a complete switch. And it was, I'm never going to do any of this again. And just everything was different.
Beyond the extreme physical pain, Tom experienced severe survivor's guilt.
You have to understand the state of mind I was in first. And so I was really a victim when I first got to the burn ward. I was stuck in this place of everyone's dead. You know, I could still see it. I could still smell it. It was still fresh. And everyone that saw me made it about me. Everyone that saw me was, oh, you're so tough and you're so special. And so the national news was calling me the miracle man, and they were sensationalizing me and my survival story. And it was all about me. And I was so pissed off because that's not where I was at. It wasn't about me. Like, go interview, you know, Matsuchinko's wife. So I wasn't in a good spot, and I was mad at God and I was pissed off at everyone. And so it was about the third night, and the nurses were my angels. The nurses were such great humans. The nurse comes into my room and she's like, hey, Tom, there's a priest in the hallway. He wants to know if you want to talk to him. And so it's not uncommon for a priest to be at the burn ward. And so I'm like, yeah, absolutely. I want to talk to him. And I was mad. I was almost like I wanted to fight, right? Like, and so this priest comes in and he completely disarms me. And how he did that was he was the first person I came across that didn't celebrate. This is what was driving me nuts about everyone. And so the first thing he said was, can we pray for your friends? And so what do you say to that? Yeah, can we, please?
Yeah.
And so we did for about a half an hour and it was really powerful and it was meaningful and we cried a lot. And at the end of it, the priest looks at me and he's like, I know who you are. He's like, I'm not sure how you're going to take this. He's like, I can't imagine, you know, laying in a bed and in the condition you're in with what you've just gone through. He's like, I've watched every single video on the news. I've looked at every picture. I read the Transportation Safety Board interviews. He's like, everyone in the world says it's not physically possible for you to be alive. He's like, you've been given a gift. It's not your job to understand God's plan. But if you can understand that you've been given a gift, right, that'll make a difference. And then that was it. He left. And I'm telling you, it affected me in such a great way. The next morning I woke up and I was like, I've been given a gift, mm-hmm. Not a victim. This is a gift. I am going to fight as hard as I did on that island to survive, to figure out why I've been given this gift. At the end of this, when I get through all this suffering, I'm going to be a better son to my father. I'm going to be a better son to my mother. I'm going to be a better brother. I'm going to be a better leader. I'm going to be a better coworker. I'm going to be a better stranger, right? I'm just going to be a better human. I'm going to find a way to figure out, you know, why I've been given this gift. I fought hard. I was positive, right? I still hated the anticipation. I still hated the burns. I was way less of an asshole about it. And I was thankful. You know, I became thankful for the burn ward instead of full resentment for it. And so it really changed the core of how I started to look at things, right? The only thing we have control over is what are you going to do about it, right? Yeah. How are you going to get through it? Right. Or you can choose to just live in that moment for the rest of your life. And that's what some people do. But it's that it was a gift. Right. I stopped being a victim. And I think to be able to somehow accept that suffering is a part of growth, then you can really try and put effort into finding out the gift. There's a gift in everything.
Thinking of his survival as a gift wasn't like a switch was flipped and he was fine. It was more like a tool to help him fight the demons he carried from that day, including his fixation on the moment the pilot offered to let them off the plane.
So when he said, we're going to do low-level flying, did you understand what that meant and what the dangers were?
Yeah, absolutely. I think all of us did. Yeah, it would be hard. It would be hard for me to try and present a stance where you didn't, right? Like we all knew where Toba Inlet was. We all knew we were flying in there. It's in the valleys and tight quarters in the mountains. We're on a float plane. The visibility is literally zero. Every one of us knew the risks. Every one of us knew we were flying to the mountains, including Peter McLeod, all of us, everyone on that aircraft. You know, everyone blamed Peter because he was the pilot, but Peter didn't want to die. So blaming him was good enough for me. I've never blamed Peter. I've always defended him.
Well, not wanting to die and being reckless are separate things.
Well, no, I agree. They are different things. So I said, I don't blame Peter. I don't. I never have. Now, what I do struggle with is that within the culture of the airlines, Peter McLeod had been reprimanded 3 times prior. And the coincidental thing about timing about that is one of the last times that he was reprimanded was 3 months prior to our accident. So that would have been in August of 2008.
That same month, Peter McLeod was reprimanded. And again, this was 3 months before Tom's crash. The same airline had another plane with a different pilot crash into the side of a mountain, killing 5. 2 people survived.
The reason Peter McLeod gave us that opportunity to speak up, I believe, after the, and I've studied this event, is because he was as scared as we were. But he didn't understand risk tolerance. He didn't understand the difference between courage and bravery. He didn't understand the pressures. There was a ton of pressure on Peter McLeod to make the decision to go. There's all kinds of contributing factors. And could you define his behavior as reckless? Yeah, it could be a descriptor. But I think it's deeper than that. And I don't blame Peter McLeod. I blame the culture that Peter McLeod was allowed to operate like that in.
But I mean, and from your perspective, the second half of that speech he gave is basically saying, put your trust in me. I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, it is. It is.
And that sort of lets you guys off the hook of speaking up.
Okay. I yes, it sure does. But let's look at it from why I struggled so much.
Yeah.
I could have just said, hey, yeah, no, Peter McLeod said it was okay. And so it's no longer my responsibility. But it's just not true, right? If we could do better at teaching our children that we are responsible for our personal safety, maybe we can improve the amount of texting and driving, drinking and driving. And listen, I believe that I'm responsible for my personal safety. And I believe that I was put in a situation that I knew was bad, that I knew was likely to be dangerous. It was unlikely, right? So again, I've studied this moment. It was the consequence was unlikely, although devastating. And so there's all of these different factors. But at the end of the day, Peter McLeod gave us that opportunity because I think he was as scared as we were and didn't know how to stop it. And so Peter McLeod doesn't get to tell me that's okay or not. Mm-hmm. I knew it was wrong. I should have. And this is where my struggle was. I should have put up my hand and said, man, this is stupid. Really? You want us to fly in the mountains blind? Come on. It's not that important. I guarantee you my friends would have been like, yeah, you know, we agree. That's what I was looking for. And so it's not good enough for me to just push that off to Peter McLeod and said, well, he said it was okay.
1 year after the accident, Tom decided to go back to the crash site to honor those that didn't survive.
And so we went on an anniversary of the plane crash. And we went to the search and rescue in that morning and I met all of them. Some of them were even retired and didn't even live in Seashelf anymore. Oh, wow. But guys came from different parts of BC just to have this almost reunion with me. And they brought the boat that they rescued me in. And so I really got to spend a day with these guys and I got to talk to them and I got to tell them, I'm sorry, you know, and you guys saved my life. And we had a good laugh and we connected. But I shared this day with them and it was really powerful how much that day impacted each of them as individuals. And they were just search and rescue. Right. And so they took us back to the island. They knew exactly where the crash was. They took us up to the crash site. I didn't realize how important it was to me, but when everyone was buried, I was in the burn ward, couldn't go to any of the funerals. And so when I went back to the island, I took a wooden cross with all their names and I erected it. And it was my opportunity to say that I was sorry. And it was my opportunity to say goodbye. And I'd never done that. And so that was really important.
Tom went on to marry Lasha, and they had two children together. Tom had the life he thought he never wanted and loved his kids and his wife. But there was still a darkness hanging over him.
Do you think this 4.5-hour plane crash would have been the worst thing in my life? But it wasn't. It was number three. Number two was the burn ward, because the burn ward was relentless and it was for a much, much longer period of time. So that was the second. But the hardest thing I ever faced was living with myself when I didn't have to focus all of my energy and my existence on the physical pain. When the physical pain went away, I had to start to live with myself and I couldn't. I couldn't get all the death out of my head. I couldn't get the fact that I knew it was wrong and I didn't say anything out of my head. I had survivor's guilt. I didn't understand why I was the one. And Matt's son doesn't have a father. And so this is where I ran away from the plane crash. And so this is where the addiction got heavy, because I I ran away. I couldn't live anymore. You know, just with the environment I was in and the people I was around, there was, you know, it's not like the first time that I was ever introduced to drugs was after the plane crash. You know, I'd partaken before. I wouldn't, you know, it wasn't life-changing. But once the crash came and I had a really hard time really kind of dealing with anything, just living with myself. And so I started to use a lot more. You know, I'd be using a lot. There was a point in my life where I couldn't even get through the day. I would book it off work. Then I tried to go to work, but I still couldn't get through the day. Then there was years that I got really fucking drunk. And then now that I'm going down this path, it's accumulating more because it's, you know, it's damaging my family. It's damaging the people that I love. It's damaging everything around me.
That damage extended to their finances.
So we were living in a nice house in my hometown community. I was making a fantastic salary. Lasha didn't have to work. We were in a position where financially she didn't have to work. And so she really wanted, and she looked at it as a gift, to be able to stay home and raise these children on her own and not have to put them in childcare. And so this is how we were. But with the amount of money, and so because of, I guess, my arrogance at that point as well, I would finance everything. We had mortgage payments, we had car payments. I had an 80-inch TV that I had payments on, like, you know, a credit card, just all maxed out. And so this is the fast lifestyle I'm living. And the more I go down the addiction path, the faster the money goes out the window. But in addition to that, it also affects your behavior. It affects your attendance. It affects your performance. It affects your attitude. It affects your core. It affects. So it only took so long before I got fired from that organization. We didn't have anything in the bank, and all we had was bills in the mail.
Yeah.
So, you know, they repoed the cars. We lost the house. We went into bankruptcy. And at that point, I moved to a little hick town community to try and get a job in Alberta. And Lasha went as far away as she could. And I don't ever blame. Like, we've already talked about this. I hate blame. And so, you know, she did what she needed to do. And she took the kids and she went to Southern Alberta. And they were really far away. It was just all falling apart because I just couldn't live with myself. And the more I couldn't live with myself and the more I ran away with myself, the more I piled up reasons as to why I couldn't live with myself, right? And it becomes this mountain. It becomes this cyclical pattern. And it was just, it was the worst place I've ever been in my life, right? Because I was responsible for everything. These were my decisions. These were my actions. And it just, but I refused to be a victim, right? So what do? You keep fighting. And so I was talking to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist had suggested that I didn't really know anything about the crash. And I hadn't accepted anything and I needed to write. But I hate writing. Like, I've got these big, thick glasses, or I hate reading, right? It's a chore to me. But I went home and I had to try something because I went through all this tragedy and I fought so hard to live on the island. And then I fought through the burn ward only to have the plane crash kill me. Right? It had taken everything. I was in bankruptcy. I was, you know, losing Lasha, like all of it. So I went home and I wrote the first time for about 2.5 hours sitting out on the deck. And then I went down my bed and I cried. I went in the fetal position. I cried for 2.5 hours. Do you know why? Because I had to go touch it. Right? And touching it hurt so much that I went and cried. And so then I started writing more. And then I touched it for a little longer. And it hurt every single time. But then I'd go back and so eventually I was able to pick it up and look at it and think about it. And I'm okay, now I don't have to be an addict anymore. Maybe I can start to live with this. And so I started to heal. And so I wrote my book and I wrote the entire thing in handwritten. I wrote the entire thing and I threw it away. I literally at the end of it, I threw it all away. And I started over again with no references. And I wrote it a second time and I threw it away. And then I wrote it a third time.
Tom's book is called Moments of Impact, if you want to check it out.
Did you keep in contact with any of the families of the men that were on the plane?
No, there's a couple. So over the course of time, you know, I have at least spoken one time to all of the families except one. And that was Kyle Adams' family. And then me and Lash were living in Fort McMurray with kids, and I got this Facebook message from Thomas Clements. And that was Wally Clements's brother. And so we talked, and he said to me that he wanted to meet me face to face, and that he was going to fly out at some point for business to Calgary. And so we were going to drive and meet at a Tim Hortons, and it was him and his wife. And he's like, listen, he's like, I came here because I have to tell you something. And he's like, man, my mom struggled for 2 years. My mom couldn't get her shit together. She couldn't accept Wally's death. And so someone finally convinced her and my dad to go to a medium. And he's like, I don't believe in mediums. I just don't. He's like, it's not my thing. But whatever. If it helps my mom, it helps my mom. And it really did. He's like, it really, really, really helped my mom so much to the point that her and my dad kept pushing me to go and talk to this medium. And I didn't want to go. He's like, but eventually they just kept pushing me. They kept pushing me. And so I just went. He's like, but I didn't go with the right attitude. He's like, I wasn't telling her shit. I wasn't cooperating, right? Like I was resistant. He's like, and so I go and I sit and I just talk to this medium. And she tells me a story of when we were in a farmhouse back in Russia, because they grew up in Russia. The fact that this woman knew that story, he's like, I'm telling you, Tom, there's not another person in this world that could have known that story. And so she starts talking and she says to me, there was a survivor. And so Thomas looks at her and he's like, yeah, there was a survivor, Tom Wilson. She's like, you have to pass him a message. It's okay. He doesn't have to feel guilty anymore. And so Thomas Clements and his wife are both, the three of us are just crying in this middle of this Tim Hortons as this guy came across the country to tell me he got a message from a medium that I didn't have to feel guilty anymore. And it was crazy.
Did that help relieve some of the guilt?
Yeah, 100% it did. It's, and I struggle with kind of describing that, is that there's still guilt. You know, it's the one thing that never goes away. You know, I have a portion of responsibility for the death of seven of my friends and coworkers. And I highlight that, and that never goes away. And so that guilt's always going to be there. But I don't know if I feel guilty anymore, because I've done the suffering. I've done the studying. I've went through it. I've looked at what I did wrong. And now not only did I look and understand at what I did wrong that day and how I contributed, I share it with everyone else so that maybe they can experience a little bit of what I see. Right. And so I've come a long way, right? Without that event, you know, I wouldn't be who I am today.
Yeah. It's like you still have guilt, but you've stopped blaming yourself.
Yes, that's a fantastic way to put it. I still recognize the guilt I carry because of my contribution, but I don't carry that burden in the manner that I used to.
Right. Today, Tom is a public speaker that shares his story internationally.
What I see is that I've come through all these different struggles and I finally put my life back together. And now I'm on a stage looking at 500 of you, and I'm touching you in a meaningful way. And so at the end of my talk, I've had countless people come up and share tears with me. I've met the coroner from the event and we shared tears. And I explained things to him in a way that he didn't understand before. Jerry Burns' nephew was at one of my events. And him and I had a meaningful conversation and I touched him in a way. But even strangers I touch in a way. And so I get this energy back. So, you know, it's been this hard journey to share and to learn and to understand and to be able to speak openly about everything that I did wrong and how I feel about it all. You know, I start my talk by saying this is the most meaningful thing I've ever done in my life. The energy I get back from doing it is amazing.
Yeah.
And that's really rewarding and encourages you to keep going.
This is Live to Tell. I'm Caitlin Van Maul. You can follow the show on Instagram and TikTok at Live to Tell Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps the show. I'll see you in 2 weeks.